From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. In a moment, we are going to turn right at Machu Picchu with Mark Adams. That's right. Rediscovering the lost city one step at a time. It's an amazing story. The next hour, underwater UFOs off the coast of California? Or is it something else? Preston Dennett joins us with that story and much more. Before we get going into some of the stories of the day, let me tell you a little bit about how my day unfolded today. First of all, my mother's going to be 83 the end of May, and she's been going through a lot of stress because of my dad's death a couple months ago. Well, she has always told my two sisters, don't ever tell George anything. I don't want him upset. And so they live by it, and it just drives me nuts. Well, tonight, one of my sisters called me and says, look, I don't want you to worry. I hate it when they start that way. But Mom just had an angiogram. She failed a stress test, and they wanted to check her out. She's okay. She's got some slight blockage. But for a woman who's 83 years old, not bad. But so I went through that. So I ran out, did the more prep of the show, went and had a little dinner. And on the way back, parked my car and did something I have never done in my life. I locked the keys in the car. Locked them in the car. Come up to my office, realize I don't have the keys on me, go all the way down, and I can see them in this little bucket on the inside of the car. And I went, how am I going to do this? Well, it's an American car. It's a Ford product. They've got a code thing there on the side of the door. And I went, hey, I'm in luck, except I don't have the code with me. I have no idea what it is. I call the dealership. Right before they close, there's a universal code numbered. So I run back down and I use it. It doesn't work. But Ford has this emergency system. You call them and the tow truck comes out. Tony comes out somewhere from Los Angeles, wherever Tony is. He gets in 3 minutes. 3 minutes. I'm in the car, got the keys, all is well. That's my day. Here's what's happening. Russia's most senior military officer says that Moscow would strike and destroy NATO missile defense sites in Eastern Europe before they came online if the U.S. pushes ahead with deployment. The threat comes as talks about the missile defense system, which the U.S. and its allies insist is aimed at Iranian missiles, appear to have stalled, so it may never happen. You know, as we reported last night, nearly 15% of people worldwide believe the world will end during their lifetime. 10% think the Mayan calendar could signify it will happen in 2012, according to a new poll. The end of the Mayan calendar, which spans about 5,125 years, on December 21st, 2012, maybe that date, has sparked interpretations and suggestions that it marks the end of the world. Who better to turn to right now but the expert, John Hoag? John, this poll, people are worried. It's over for them. What's going on?
Oh, gosh. I've been 30 years at this. I have seen so many doomsdays come and go, and I can tell you that what I've been telling you for years is that you and I will be there at 2012, and if the world ends, I will eat Nostradamus' hat. I'm quite convinced I won't need to do that. Frankly, I don't have his hat, but that's our secret.
I think we'll be talking well into 2013 together, won't we?
2013, 14, 15, the 2020s. In fact, I would say that looking at the prophecies of Nostradamus and others, the convergence of objective extrapolation of where we're going and how we're using the world, how we're misusing the world, meets the subjective prophecies of the world and astrological predictions around the 2020s, which, you know, I've said often on the show is the roaring 2020s. So, you know, the one thing I'm absolutely sure is going to happen is that once we enter 2013, we'll completely forget 2012. And strangely enough, we've actually already experienced 2012.
That's right. You were telling us last time that it may have already happened.
It happened 13 years ago.
and we got through it.
We did. And yet, at the same time, what often happens in the anticipation of prophecy is a predilection to hyperbole. We get excited. We get emotionally involved. We see these amazing images, and this is also true of the great prophets. They see what they see, and it kind of excites their emotions. They overindulge the interpretation, and then the truth of it is actually a lot less, more hosed down and tempered down. Things definitely 13 years ago began to shift. In the winter solstices of 1998, 1999, which is the true 2012, we saw the beginning of climate change. We saw the beginning
That's
of
right.
many things that we're slowly, slowly, in the quickening of history, beginning to accelerate from that point. And this brings back something that I've experienced dealing with talking to Native American prophets and traditions, and dealing with their traditions, is that there in Indian time, we try to project our Western instant prophecy time on them.
Well, it's sobering, John, to know that you feel as if things are going to be okay. Thanks, John. John Hoag, got to get him back for a full program soon enough. Aspirin could be as effective as more expensive drugs for heart failure patients with a normal heart rhythm, according to researchers. Their study on more than 2,000 patients published in the New England Journal of Medicine said aspirin was as effective as commonly prescribed drugs, warfarin. It said each drug had risks, but they had similar benefits as well. Facebook, as the price range for its initial public offering at $28 to $35 a share, values the company at close to $100 billion. Can you believe that? 14 and counting, that's a number of federal loan modification programs currently in place, each one targeting financially stressed homeowners to help them stay current on their mortgage payments and avoid foreclosure. Since September of 2008, when the collapse of the housing market caused a credit crisis that led to a worldwide financial panic, an estimated 3.1 million U.S. homes have completed the foreclosure process, but they say that is not nearly enough. And Americans, what are they doing? More Americans now are stashing cash, not in banks, but in home safes in record numbers. They're putting everything in safes these days. It's food, guns, and now cash. They've lost trust with the banks. But the banks and the Fed, they keep printing money, Greg Hunter, don't they?
Yes, they do. And the reason why is because I think the economy is rolling over. Here in the U.S., we just got bad numbers on retail sales, auto sales, the soft numbers on housing. The prices are down again, according to Case-Shiller. ADP says we only added 119,000 jobs. Job cuts by Challenger Grain Christmas. They're reporting another 7% increase in April. The economy's rolling over. And we're getting signals from the Federal Reserve that from Ben Bernanke last week, all the tools are very much on the table. His quote, Fed presidents were on this week on CNBC saying, oh, we can expand the balance sheet. And, you know, there's room for more accommodation. And the reason why they're saying this is because the economy is rolling over, not just here, but in Europe. Europe is in big trouble.
Well, it's going to, you know, Greece has still got problems. France has problems. They've
France
all
has
got
huge
problems.
Spain has more than twice the debt of Portugal, Ireland, and Greece combined.
Yet some people in this country, Greg, feel as if they're doing okay. And I guess they are.
Sure, the investor class is doing okay because, you know, a lot of this money from the Federal Reserve with QE 1, 2, 3, we bought 60% of the nation's debt. The Federal Reserve bought 60% of the nation's treasuries last year, according to the Wall Street Journal. Yes, some people are being propped up, and they're being propped up by printed money. And that's the beauty of having the world's reserve currency. But people like Egon von Graeus, who runs Matterhorn Capital Management, is saying that what we have facing us, particularly in Europe, and American banks have $1 trillion worth of exposure at least. But what we're facing in Europe is worse than 2008.
I think they're going to just have to scrap the whole thing, Greg, and start all over. Greg Hunter's website, USAWatchdog.com. So would you go to a hotel that was underwater? I wouldn't. Dubai has announced plans to build an underwater hotel in a sign there that the Emirate is shaking off its financial crisis and returning to the grandiose projects of its boom time heyday. A company called Dry Docks World is going to build this submerged hotel. And if you have a room there, you'll be able to see things swim by. At coasttocoastam.com, take a look at the picture, The Scream. Remember that? It was done in 1895 by the Norwegian expressionist Edvard Munch. It sold at auction for $119.9 million. $119.9 million. Who bought it? Anonymous. We don't know. Okay, Machu Picchu. You know, it was highlighted on Ancient Aliens on the History Channel. They interviewed me for it. Up next, Mark Adams, an incredible story. He is next on Coast to Coast AM. Fun, informative hour for you tonight. Mark Adams has been fascinated with lost cities and sacred ruins since he saw Raiders of the Lost Ark. That was when he was 12. Mark has explored and gathered information as part of his life's work. He's written for publications ranging from National Geographic Adventure to GQ, Rolling Stone, currently researching the lost city of Atlantis. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, George, thanks for having me.
My pleasure, too. Hey, tell us a little bit about Machu Picchu. You know, I was interviewed along with so many other people for the History Channel, Ancient Aliens. And tell me a little bit about where it is. It's the base of the Andes Mountains. It's way up there, isn't it?
The thing about Machu Picchu is it became lost for many centuries to the outside world because it's deep in the Andes Mountains of Peru. It's right at the spot where the Andes, which, you know, are peaks that can hit up to 20,000 feet high, sort of crashes into the beginning of the Amazon basin. And it's on a 2,000 foot tall, I guess you'd call it a massif, almost like a cliff. So from below, if you were passing by, you'd almost certainly be passing by on the river or the river basin. You would never, ever know it was way up there. It's really well hidden. And until you get right there on top, you would have no idea what is hiding on the top of it.
Mark, was it a structure that was built, you know, out of a structure that was there and they chiseled away at it? Or did they bring the stone up there?
I think it was a little of building from stone that was on the site and quite possibly bringing stone from nearby. I mean, this is a nearly sheer cliff face. You would have to drag, you know, granite blocks up there. And there are some, you know, perfectly chiseled granite blocks at Machu Picchu that are, you know, the size of your washer and dryer and refrigerator. So I don't think this stuff was carried very far.
No, not at all, unless they had a UFO lifted up for them or something like that. What's the legend behind Machu Picchu?
Well, you know, Machu Picchu was originally known as the Lost City of the Incas, the Inca Empire. I mean, you talk about the collapse of societies on this show a lot, and the Incas are like the textbook case of an empire that never saw it coming. You know, in 1532, they had the largest empire ever seen in the Western Hemisphere. Two brothers are fighting to be emperor. Several years of civil war, an epidemic hits the empire, kills tens of thousands of people. At that very moment, Francisco Pizarro shows up, the Spaniard, with 168 men and a few dozen horses, the technology of the time, which is Toledo steel swords and some long-barreled rifles, and basically takes over the whole country in a matter of weeks, takes over the entire Inca Empire with 168 men.
My gosh.
So supposedly, the way the legend began was a group of Inca nobles took their women and took large caches of gold and silver, which the Incas had plenty of, and ran off to a city high in the mountains. And that became known as the Lost City of the Incas. And when Hiram Bingham, who's the man who rediscovered Machu Picchu 100 years ago, came to Peru in 1911, he was looking for that Lost City of the Incas.
How many people do you think the city can hold?
You know, Machu Picchu is not a huge place. It was obviously designed primarily for the Inca emperor and perhaps a small court. You know, so at that very site, maybe a few hundred people.
Oh, that's all?
Yeah, yeah. It's not a metropolis, but there are satellite settlements around it. So it probably supported a few thousand people.
Those were the only survivors of the Inca Empire?
Well, that was the legend, you know. I mean, there were plenty of people who survived. You know, the Spaniards came in, and there were still millions of Incas living. you know, that city has never actually been found, as far as we know. It may have been found down in the jungle, but no one has ever found any of the treasure or anything.
What gave you the idea to try to recreate the original expedition to find it?
Well, you know, I was working at National Geographic Adventure magazine, which, you know, covers places like Machu Picchu.
They sure do.
And places like that. And my wife is Peruvian, so I went to Peru fairly often. But we always went to Lima, which is a sort of cosmopolitan city on the coast. It's kind of like the Los Angeles of Peru. You know, you've got valet parking and Starbucks and all that. And I'd never actually been to the Andes. But we had a friend who was Quechua. Now, Quechua is the sort of the native Indian people of the Andes Mountains. Completely different world from the coast of Lima. You know, this friend of ours would you know, tell us in the town that she grew up, you know, you'd go to church in the morning, and then if you had a problem, you'd go visit the shaman in the afternoon. You know, the people would give offerings to the Apus or the sacred mountains because the Apus could help you solve your problems. Shortly before our first child was born, this woman whose name is Nati told us that she kept having this dream that my wife had a tree growing in her stomach. And we're like, I don't know what that means. You know, the Quechua people tend to put great...
Sure, you don't know if she's sick or what when they
say that. Exactly, and, you know, lo and behold, she went to the doctor one day, and she's like, guess what, I'm pregnant. So, you know, I mean, there was just enough of that to really, you know, tease my interest and make me think, you know, I've got to get in there and take a look at some of these places while it's still possible.
The Inca, tell me about the Inca.
You know, the Inca were a fascinating group. They put together this empire really quickly. I mean, there are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of tribes in South America. And the Inca really didn't start to grow until about 1100 or so. And then they built this, you know, small empire around the holy city of Cusco, which is where you go now to catch the train to Machu Picchu. And around 1450 or so, a fellow who's known as like the Alexander the Great of the Incas named Pachacutec, who is also believed to have built Machu Picchu, just started conquering tribes left and right and started amassing this enormous empire up and down the west coast of South America. And like I said, it's probably the largest empire ever seen in the Western Hemisphere. And they were, you know, fearsome fighters, but they were also known as like the absolute best organized empire we may have ever seen in this hemisphere.
Mark, how similar were the Aztecs from Mexico with the Mayans of Central America to the Incas of South America?
You know, there are some similarities. You know, both built huge stone buildings, or all three, and all three worshipped the sun. But there were some differences as well, because it's not known if the Aztecs, Mayas, and the Incas ever, you know, even communicated. That's not been proven. There are some theories that they did. But it's generally believed that Central America and South America, there wasn't a lot of cross-pollination at that time.
How advanced were they?
Oh, incredibly advanced in some ways. You know, in like I said, in their organizational ways, and we're still figuring this out, they were highly advanced. The Spaniards arrived and couldn't believe that they found, you know, 10, 20 years worth of food and clothing stockpiled.
Stored away.
Yeah, that the Incas had put up.
I mean, preppers. They were preppers.
They were. I mean, it was almost like a Stalinist socialist society, and that you had this ruling class that lived very well, and then this, you know, everybody else who was expected to give, was called the mitah, which was sort of their tax, which was you had to give 1/3 of your year over to the state, and that could mean fighting in the...
Nothing's changed.
Army. Well, in a lot of ways, yeah. You know, you fight in the army or you work on somebody's farm or something like that. And, of course, the Incas were really well known for their building techniques, which we're still amazed by today. You know, you go down to Cusco, you go to Machu Picchu, and you see these enormous white stone buildings. And, you know, famously, you can't fit a knife blade between the two rocks. And yet we're not 100% sure how these things were put together.
Were they into human sacrifice?
Sometimes, yes. They were known to sacrifice, I think it was teenage girls or pre-teenage girls, on mountaintops.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they were...
To the gods they went, right?
Yeah, I mean, they sacrificed a lot of llamas, but they also, you know, bodies have been found frozen due to global warming. You know, some of these mountaintops have started thawing out, and they've found, you know, complete bodies buried with relics and treasures and things like
that. Mark, we'll talk more about this. I want to know if they left us any secret codes. Our special guest this hour, Mark Adams, he's author of the book Turn Right at Machu Picchu. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Mark Adams will take some of your calls. Mark, did the Inca, did they leave any special codes or secrets behind?
Well, you know, George, for the longest time, experts thought that the Incas were not as fully developed as some other societies because they didn't develop three things. They didn't develop the wheel, they didn't develop the arch, and they didn't develop a form of writing. But as it turns out, they did find the wheel. They used it for children's toys, but they just found it to be completely useless in the Andes, where the topography just goes up and down. They developed their own kind of arch, which is a sort of trapezoid, which was perfect for withstanding earthquakes in the Andes, which is why the buildings at Machu Picchu, you know, 600 years after it was put up, are still standing, while the cities in Lima and Cusco have been knocked down twice by earthquakes in that time. And as it turns out, they did have a form of recording information. It just wasn't written. It was a sort of knotted cord called the quipu. And the quipus were kept by a sort of caste of priests called the quipu camayac when the Incas were in power. And the Spaniards never quite understood what these things were used for. They thought they were used as maybe like an abacus or an accounting device for keeping track of all those stores of grain and clothing and things. But they never fully decoded what they were. And the Spaniards being the Spaniards, and since they arrived during the Inquisition, all these things were declared, you know, pagan idols, cast into the fire. And today only a few hundred of them remain. Well, a couple of decades ago, some folks at Harvard started putting together a database, and they noticed that some of the knots turned one way, some of the knots turned the other way, some had special colorings on them. And it turns out that these quipus are not just numbers. They may also contain information, and we're just starting to decode what that information is.
Any idea what it could mean?
The only one they've decoded so far was sort of a zip code, the name of a town. And like I said, there are not a whole lot of these left. I mean, some of them are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of cords tied together. Some are just a tiny string with one or two knots in them. You know, they're hoping in the next year or two to come up with a full database. And who knows what could be what kind of information could be held in those cords.
When Hiram Bingham found Machu Picchu, was he looking for it or did he stumble across it?
Well, he was looking for the lost city of the Incas, and he had some pretty good information. And Bingham was a good detective. He asked around. He knew that there was something up on that ridge 2,000 feet above. He just had no idea that it was this glorious white stone city that we now know.
And was it covered in vegetation?
It was. It was almost completely grown over. You know, there were full-sized trees growing on some of the most famous buildings that you see in photographs now.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Which I guess the Inca trimmed. They kept it landscaped.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when you have an entire, not quite slave labor pool, but certainly surf-like labor pool, you can do pretty much anything you want.
All right, to the phones we go. East of the Rockies, Chris in Fort Myers, Florida. Go ahead, Chris. Thanks for calling.
How you doing, George?
Great, Chris.
How you doing, sir? With the technology that we have today, I don't understand how they was able to do this. I don't understand rocks and stones and rock hammers and you know, iron chisels. How could they make the stones fit together so well? You got the Egyptians, you got the Mayans, you got the Incas, the oldest city in the world. They found a new Japan temple offshore. I just don't understand how they was able to do this without technology from outer space or something.
Yeah, well, in the case of the Incas, they didn't even have iron tools. All they had was brass, you know, and brass isn't going to get you that far against a huge chunk of granite. The best theory I've seen so far is that they developed these, what they call hammer stones, which are these ultra-hard rocks that they would find in a riverbed or something, and sort of bounce them off of the rock like they were jacks or something, like they were playing jacks, and these would just flake off pieces of granite until they had the perfect shape. You can actually see on YouTube, there are some videos of guys doing this modern day, and it's absolutely fascinating.
Any special powers when you're there?
You know, I've never known anyone, and, you know, I'm a complete empiricist who believes in science and facts and all that, but I've never known anyone who stepped out into the ruins of Machu Picchu and did not have a sense that there was something deeper going on there, that there was something mystic or spiritual. I mean, the term I usually use is that it feels like a natural cathedral. It was definitely built in that spot for a very special purpose. And actually, recent theories have started to sort of speculate what that purpose might have been. You know, archaeoastronomy has been looking into that, and you know, some of the findings have been fascinating.
Were they experts in astronomy?
They may have been. We don't really know because so few records have been found. But, you know, the incredible thing about Machu Picchu that a fellow named Johann Reinhard started to piece together is that if you stand in the ruins and you look directly to the cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west, there are holy mountains, apus as they call them, you know, at 90 degrees in each direction. The holiest river in the Inca Empire, the Urubamba, almost wraps itself completely around the ridge on which Machu Picchu sits. It's almost like an island. Like I mentioned before, this is where the Amazon hits the Andes, you know, a very sacred piece of land. You know, if there were a Geiger counter for sacred territory in the Inca Empire, you know, the spot where Machu Picchu was built would absolutely bury the needle.
Do the Peruvians now understand the significance of this area?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. I mean, the Andes are still, you know, a very traditional place. You know, this is a place where, you know, a lot of the people still hold on to their sort of pantheistic beliefs. You know, older people will give offerings of coca leaves to the apus, to the mountains, especially the holiest ones.
They're valuable there, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, everybody chews coca in Peru. When I got to Peru, I bought it's like the size of a family-sized bag of potato chips of coca leaves, you know, which would give me 5 to 10 years in San Quentin.
You know, it's supposed to be good for you, isn't it?
It is. It's packed with vitamins. And the thing about walking around in the Andes is you never know when you're going to get to a 15,000-foot-high pass, and coca not only provides a little kick of energy, it's not like doing cocaine or anything, but it also alleviates what they call soroche, or altitude sickness.
It's good for the heart, I hear.
It's good for the heart, and everybody in the Andes eats so many carbohydrates, so much corn, so many potatoes. Apparently there's something in coca that helps the body break down those carbohydrates.
Do they make any special alignments, Mark, where, you know, if there was a full moon or a special rising of the sun, that it would do something?
Well, you know, the most incredible thing I've probably seen in my entire life happened on the June solstice, which is the winter solstice of South America. And I was at Machu Picchu, and I was standing above the most beautiful building there, which is a sort of semicircular building known as the Sun Temple. And it has a couple of sort of strangely shaped windows that face east. So we're standing there waiting for the sun to rise, and my guide says, you know, just keep your eye on that mountain to the east. So we watch, and slowly the sun begins to rise, and it comes up over this peak, which is directly to the east of Machu Picchu, sort of hovers above the top of the peak like a halo around Jesus' head in a Renaissance painting. You know, it shoots a beam of light to the right, which sort of illuminates what's called the Sun Gate, beautiful stone entranceway to Machu Picchu, goes up a little bit more, shoots a beam of light to the left, and illuminates this small peak there, which is known as Huayna Picchu, which is the sort of green rhino horn that you see at the back of any photograph of Machu Picchu behind the ruins. And then this sort of wave of light starts to unroll through the ruins of Machu Picchu, almost block by block. It arrives at the Sun Temple, and a beam of light shoots through one of these windows onto a sort of circular rock inside the Sun Temple. You know, on that piece of granite inside the temple, is a sort of missing chunk of something that's been broken off. It looks almost like the base of a trophy where the trophy's been cracked away.
Sure.
And in the middle of that base, a perfect rectangle of light forms, and it's almost impossible to see from the window and the angle and the sun how this thing could be formed. And you have to wonder, you know, what was this illuminating 500 years ago? What was there? It's the most incredible thing I've ever seen.
That's exciting. You know, Eric von Däniken's career was built on those Nazca lines in Peru.
Right.
Which, you know, the Chariot of the Gods was based on. Did you do any work in that area, Mark?
No, Nazca is several hundred miles from Cusco.
Is it? Okay.
And it's believed that those are pre-Inca. There was the Nazca people up there. But, I mean, those are built on a scale that are, you know, dwarfs Machu Picchu. You know, those are thousands of feet long. Those are absolutely incredible and worth seeing as well.
Let's go to Salt Lake City. Julia is with us, west of the Rockies. Hi, Julia. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you, George. I know you for a long time. I'm from Lima, Peru. My grandpa is there from the mountains.
Speaking
Quechua. My question is about the Quechuas. They're the civilization that's part of the Incas, because the Inca was different where the Quechua is, correct?
It's sort of all become muddled and mixed. You know, technically the Incas, before the time the Spaniards arrived, the term just referred to the sort of ruling class, the nobility.
Mm-hmm.
And then the term has since come to mean sort of all of the people who were in Peru at that time. And since everybody was stripped of their titles and everything, everyone sort of was knocked down by the Spaniards to this very low serf-like level. And what was the language of the Inca Empire has sort of evolved into the Quechua language and the Quechua people of the Andes.
Okay. So the Incas, what I understood when I learned about the history,
mm-hmm.
The Incas, what I learned when I was little, there was the 14 Incas, and then the Incas was the translating. Incas mean the son of the sun.
Exactly. And that's how the emperor was also known as the Inca, to make it even more confusing. And he held his power because he was supposedly the son of the sun. He was known as the Sapa Inca. He was believed to be a god living among people.
Thanks, Julia, for calling. In the moments we have left, Mark, let me also ask you about your latest work you're working on, The Search for Atlantis. How did that come about?
Well, you know, I was working on the Machu Picchu book, and when you're looking about lost cities, inevitably you come across Atlantis time and again.
Sure.
And I started, you know, I never really thought much about Atlantis. I thought maybe it was, you know, an old legend or something. And I didn't realize that this had all come out of the works of Plato, arguably the smartest person who ever lived, the Greek philosopher, and that people are actively looking for Atlantis all around the globe. So I've started, you know, researching this and looking into the various operations where people are looking for Atlantis. And, I have to say I was fairly skeptical when I began. But as time goes by, I am more and more convinced that someday someone is going to find something that meets the criteria.
I think so, too. Do you think it's out there where Santorini was?
You know, there's Santorini. There's a spot in southern Spain, which may also be the lost city of Tartessus, which is a famous lost city. Some people think maybe it was in Malta.
See, I think it had to be close enough where Plato really knew what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, there are theories that it was a continent that sunk in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, but that's just, you know, physically highly, highly, highly improbable. Some people think he was referring to America, but then, you know, how could a Greek boat get across the Atlantic Ocean and back? So I think it almost certainly has to be somewhere in the Mediterranean area.
I think so, too. So are you going to go cruising around looking?
I'm going to go around later this year, start looking around the Mediterranean and see some of these sites and see what kind of insights I can come up with myself.
Mark, this book here that we're talking about, Turn Right at Machu Picchu, is it available at Amazon and other bookstores?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, and any good bookstore you can find.
What drives you for these mysteries, Mark?
You know, you just want to find out, you know? I mean, I think the most interesting question of any story is why. You know, why was this thing built and why did it disappear? And lost cities are you know, knee deep in that sort of stuff.
Well, they sure are. In this particular case, when you did your research on Machu Picchu, did you come across anything surprising that you did not expect?
You know, the thing that really shocked me about Machu Picchu is that it's sort of an island in the middle of the Andes where civilization has encroached because so many people go there every year. Almost a million people go to Machu Picchu every year, though. You get 5, 10, 15 miles past Machu Picchu, and, you know, it's as if time stopped. It could be 100 years ago. It could be 200 years ago. You know, we went 60 miles west of Machu Picchu.
And how old is that area? What do you think?
You know, I mean, it's
600 years?
Oh, at least 600 years.
At least.
You've got the Incas, and they built on top of other cultures, and, you know, they just pulled some gold relics out of the ground out in the jungle that, you know, were at least 1,000 years old, so they were pre-Inca. And, you know, 60 miles west of Machu Picchu, there are uncontacted tribes. You know, I was out there looking at some ruins on my trip, and the head archaeologist said, "Hey, Mark, if you see any people wearing what looks like a dress and their hair is cut like a bowl cut, you run. Those guys live by their own laws." I was like, "Oh, man. You're not in New York City anymore."
You know, I would guess until they saw those coming from Europe, they were pretty docile to most people. What do you think?
Well, the Incas were sort of, I mean, they almost used, like,
other than the sacrificing part,
benevolent mafia tactics. You know, they would go to a tribe adjoining their territory and say, you know, "Look, we'd really like you to join us.
Yeah.
We don't want to make this difficult.
A little protection."
"But we are the Incas, and you know what we can do." And mostly...
"Now give us your women and join the team."
Basically. Most tribes played along, but a lot of them didn't. And, you know, a lot of other tribes joined forces with the Spaniards when the Spaniards arrived because they hated the Incas.
What does it tell you about humankind, Mark? I mean, that's all they do is fight.
Yeah. Yeah, you know.
It baffles me.
I mean, to me, the takeaway from the Inca Empire is just, if you take your eye off the ball and you're running an empire and two or three things happen and you're not paying attention, the whole thing can just collapse.
Sure.
Like that, you know, and people get complacent and then, you know, they go on with their lives, but they don't see these things sneaking up on them. And if you had told the Inca Emperor, his name was Atahualpa, that... And he knew that these Spaniards had arrived. He had spies all throughout the Andes, and he just didn't give them a second thought. He was worried about he'd finally just captured his brother, whom he'd been fighting with for years and years. And
big mistake.
If he had just sent, you know, a battalion of troops down there and annihilated the Spaniards, you know, the Inca Empire would have gone on.
Yeah, he could have swarmed over the 160+.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, he gave them an opening, and Pizarro certainly took it.
And they took it indeed. Mark, thank you so much. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM because we're going to talk about something that could be in the water off the coast of California and so much more with our special guest, Preston Dennett, on Coast to Coast AM.